a guy was cycling to work at about 6 o'clock in the morning, and he saw flames and you know, something on fire. And they obviously wanted to know why he was on fire, why he was dead. If the victim were to be 9 years old or a, you know, 75-year-old woman or a pensioner or something, it's probably not even going to make a headline. It's not going to, certainly not make a front page story.
I'm Nicola Tallant, and you're listening to Crime World, a podcast about criminals, drugs, and the sins of the underworld in Ireland and across the globe. Some mothers would do anything for their sons, and Sophie Coconis proved her loyalty. Drug dealer Loica Gee's body was discovered by a cyclist at Mitcham Common in September 2020, which led police in London to the home of Raphael Coconis, a 34-year-old who's believed to have owed him money. But their investigations didn't stop at the assault which led to his death after he was invited around to Raphael's flat, and instead led officers to the door of his elderly mother, who they discovered had helped him in the cover-up. Today I'm talking with journalist Chris Summers, editor of Total Crime, who covered their trial. He tells me the story of a drugs row, of a crime scene deep clean, and of a family matriarch who went a step beyond to help her son. This is Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com. Sophia Coconis, unusual to see the matriarch of a family before the courts. The women usually work away in the background and maybe don't take such a hands-on role in anything. But you've been watching this, and very small in stature lady, I have to say, from the photographs I've seen of her making her way in and out of court. Does she look like an ordinary granny?
Yeah, actually, the police have put out a mugshot of her as well, which doesn't do her many favours either. But she's 70 years of age, and she's obviously had a hard life. And
has she a conviction herself, dating back some time? I think maybe when she was in her 50s, she was caught up with something.
Well, she was actually acquitted of that charge. She might be quite a cunning gangland matriarch, possibly, or an entirely innocent woman up until now.
Okay. Anyway. Up until now. And now what we know is that she's been convicted of helping her son clean up after a murder. My mother would be horrified if she received that phone call, I have to say, and it would take quite a lot to horrify her. But definitely if I told her I had a body in the house and I needed help getting rid of it, I think that would be the final straw. So what happened and when did this occur?
In September 2020, the police were suddenly tipped off, rather bizarrely. I mean, a horrible way to discover something like this. Not, there's a, probably a nice way, but a guy was cycling to work on an early shift, about 6 o'clock in the morning, and he was cycling along a road which sort of runs past the perimeter of Mitcham Common, which is kind of a quite large area of open land in South London. And he saw flames and you know, something on fire. It later emerged that was the body of Jean-Luc Gouet, which had been set alight about 2 hours earlier. So it was quite, you know, odd that it was still burning.
Mm.
But yeah, so immediately the police knew, you know, something's up here, and they realised during their investigation that Gouet was actually, you know, he was a drug dealer. I think sort of mid-level, not big time, but not, you know, tiny either. So he was dealing in sort of tens of thousands of pounds worth of drugs. And they obviously wanted to know why he was on fire, why he was dead.
The 2 hours a body burning, was there any way for them to discover exactly how he had been killed, or was that evidence destroyed?
That was also a really strange thing. I think that probably explains why, you know, his killer was convicted of manslaughter rather than murder, because the post-mortem couldn't explain. He had head injuries, but I don't think he didn't have a fractured skull. And I think reading between the lines, there'd been a, you know, a fight or a disturbance, a scuffle at the flat where he was sort of ambushed, basically. And he obviously was hit on the head with something, and he fell, you know, fell down. And I think they sort of think that he might have just sort of choked on his own blood died.
They don't know the actual cause of death.
His injuries were not sort of bad enough that it was absolutely so clear you can only have a murder charge, you know. So,
And not to get too graphic here, although I'm going to get a little bit, but presumably after the fire, that the only remains were bone and organs, etc., which may have shown cause of death, were no longer testable.
That was the other strange thing, that it was not, you know, again, not to get too graphic, but from what we were hearing in court, the body was not totally destroyed like you're thinking of, like I imagined after two hours of being on fire. But I don't know whether they'd put an accelerant only on parts of the body. I think it was just the torso that was burnt, and you know, the limbs were not burnt, and I think the head was fairly, you know, intact. So there was quite a lot of there's quite a lot for the pathologist to go on when it came to looking into that.
So I challenge you then on saying that Granny Coconus might have known what she was doing, because obviously she has just been convicted here in relation to helping in this situation. But where Gwee had been was in her son Raphael Coconus's apartment, and he'd gone there as this kind of row had ensued a month previous over a drug debt, which is what we constantly hear really in these gang related killings. There's always money owed. There's accusations of drugs going missing, or somebody gets in the frame for, you know, not paying up. And they're always kind of like, when you consider a life, a small amount of money, but when you consider trying to gather that over, you know, a 40,000, in this case, 46,000 euro dispute, when you think of trying to have to gather that in cash, I mean, where would you even start? Normal people. But tell us exactly what happened there between those two, and how this kind of row had been culminating in what happened to Gwee.
Well, from what we understand, Raphael Coconus, who is one of Sophia's sons, she had several, he was working for Gwee, either dealing drugs or, you know, certainly looking after drugs for him. And he had, you know, been given an amount of cocaine, 40 grand's worth of cocaine to look after, and it went missing, apparently during a burglary. Now, this apparently was a real burglary, because Raphael Coconus reported it to the police, but he strangely didn't mention the drugs that had been taken. He only mentioned some jewellery, about £20,000 worth of jewellery. So he reported that to the police. So it sounds like he was actually burgled. You know, as you imagine, you know, sometimes people know who has drugs in their house, and it may have been that, you know, they knew exactly what they were going to find. Anyway, so Gwee says to him, you know, well, that's your debt. You know, that's, you were looking after it. You owe me 40,000. And he was a huge guy. He was like, I think he was at least 6'2", 18 stone, kind of a scary dude. So you don't want to mess with him. And he wanted his 40 grand back, and it went on for quite a while. There was evidence of a lot of phone calls between the Coconus family. I think Raphael called his mother quite an early point saying, you know, what am I going to do about this? Of course, we don't know whether he really knew what happened to the drugs, and whether there was more to it than that. But at the end of the day, he kept saying to Gwee, yeah, I'm going to pay you. I've come up with some of the money. If you come to my flat in Streatham in South London, I can give it to you. Raphael then gets one of his friends to come over. I think he just sort of wants some backup in case it all goes badly wrong, which it did. We don't know exactly what happened, but a fight breaks out, and, Gway, who was a bigger guy, but maybe he was being caught by surprise. He ends up dead on the floor, and Rafael Coconos's friend just immediately runs away. He flees back to Cambridge, and he was eventually acquitted of the manslaughter because, you know, he just said, well, I had no idea, you know, anything like that was going to happen. Anyway, and then Raphael has this body to dispose of, quite a large body as well.
From a flat in central South London, a busy area. So do we know what happened next? How do they get the body from there to the field?
It takes place over two separate nights. The first night, the body is somehow taken and put into a car. I think possibly in a suitcase or, you know, packaged up. So any nosy neighbors don't see exactly what it is. You know, in the middle of the night as well, it's put in a car and, taken away. And then the flat is cleaned up quite to some extent, because obviously there was a lot of blood. And then the following night, again, in the middle of the night, about 4 o'clock in the morning, they take the body. Well, Raphael drives his Mercedes with the car in the body in the back to Mitcham Common. His mother follows behind. You know, the matriarch. She follows behind in her own car. She doesn't appear to go to the actual scene where the body was set on fire, but she stays in phone contact with her son. So she presumes, you know, it sounds like she's sort of guiding him, or certainly
operating maybe as a spotter in case any police or anyone comes along.
Yeah, she may have been that doing that role. Anyway, and then they drive off thinking that they've got, you know, got rid of him, and it comes back to bite them.
Now, seven people in total were brought in on this and charged before the courts. There was a number of acquittals. A brother of Raphael is found not guilty of perverting the course of justice, a friend also, and two others are found not guilty. But Raphael himself is found guilty of manslaughter after he pleads guilty, if I'm correct.
Yeah, he pleaded guilty straight away, quite early, yeah.
And his mother, Sophia, who pleaded not guilty to perverting the course of justice, but ultimately was convicted of that. It was a strange set of circumstances, but I think ultimately what you're getting is a little window into the underworld and what goes on, what happens, and who can and will be capable of being involved. There was a couple of things there as well that I noticed jump out at me as regards to Raphael, who is, by the way, he's the older of, you know, for being an underling of Gui, who's only 23. He's 34, quite significantly older than his drug boss. But there's some trappings of wealth there. He's reporting 20,000 worth of jewellery being stolen in a burglary. Whether that was or wasn't, we don't know. He certainly reported that. He's driving a Mercedes car with his boss's body in the boot. He's obviously been making some money in the underworld. And ultimately, he is, up to this point, a nobody. I mean, these people haven't really come on the radar in London gangland terms. You know, Dublin itself, we know certain characters that come to the fore again and again, and we speak about them, but there's hundreds of others who are beneath the radar. And clearly in London, given the size and scale of the city, it's that multiplied by God knows what. What is the gang scene like there? And, you know, what sort of a percentage do you feel of these crimes are actually coming before the Old Bailey where you cover?
There are a lot of these sort of low-level, fairly low-level drug dealers who are, I mean, I dealt with another case a year or so ago, which were involving a guy who was murdered, drugs involved, very, very grisly case. His body was chopped up. But again, not linked to any major sort of crime family you've ever heard of, or, you know, the mafia, or even in any Irish gangs. You know, they're just, you know, they're getting their drugs from somewhere and they're selling it on down at street level. But these people are constantly, you know, backstabbing each other, ripping each other off, don't really trust each other. So it's a really, you know, it's a recipe for murder, you know.
Yeah, and they're very, as you say, grisly, these murders that do come before the courts. You know, in the ordinary world, killing somebody, bundling them into the boot of a car, travelling across a city and setting them alight in a field, you know, you wouldn't hear that too often outside of gangland crime. I often wonder with London, you know, most people still associated with the East End and with the Crays and all those famous names of the past. But London is such a majorly multicultural city. And when we travel to it, you kind of, you know, you do really, that really stands out, even from Ireland, which is getting, it's getting increasingly more multicultural over the past few decades, but it's nowhere near London. What do you have in London? Do you have areas, do you have the city divided into areas anymore? Are estates literally divided? Or do you have multicultural gangs ruling particular turf?
Well, I mean, the at street level, the main gangs, you know, who are tend to be sort of young guys in their late teens to early 20s, although obviously sometimes they stay in those gangs, or they go to prison, come back out again, but they're still kind of affiliated, so they might be in their 30s. But they are, you know, the gangs like Tottenham, Mandem, people like that, they tend to be sort of, they represent the demographic of where they're from. So Hackney, Tottenham, you know, they would be largely Black, British or Afro-Caribbean, some white kids, some Greek Cypriot, Turkish Cypriot. Nowadays, quite a lot of Eritrean and, you know, all sorts of nationalities that have come in as migrants, Albanians, Kosovans, you know, whoever's growing up in that area will join that gang. But they, I obviously I'm wary of generalising, but, you know, they tend to, a lot of them, another case in Northwest London, gangs from Stonebridge, quite a famous area. They are mainly Black British gangs, you know, with sometimes, you know, Jamaican influences or, you know, basically rap culture, you know, obviously quite often grime artists and stuff like that. So they're your sort of your retailers of drugs, as it were. But above them are, you know, wholesalers, and then, you know, above them, even, you know, the biggers, you know, like the, well, I guess wherever they're getting their drugs, ultimately it could be Mexican cartels or Colombians, Russians. But yeah,
it's definitely very trans-global, the drugs world, you know, and accepting of all cultures. That sort of racism thing doesn't really exist within it. It's whoever has money and is willing to do business is welcome. But like, is most of the gangland crime, will the groups go to war against one another, or do they kind of stick within their own cultural groupings and, you know, infight within that?
Yeah, well, you do get infighting within ethnic groups. For example, the Tottenham Turks and the Hackney Turks are two very, 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 you know, arch rival gangs who are both Turkish stroke Kurdish from North London. In fact, just today, the Jermaine Baker inquiry has come out, which was a young Black guy who was shot dead. He was part of a gang that were about to spring a guy called Izzet Eren, who's one of the leaders of the Tottenham Turks. So there's been quite an interesting, I've been looking at those gangs. It's quite interesting how the you know, Tottenham Turks and the Hackney Turks, both of them tend to employ you know, Black guys to do a lot of their dirty work. You know, do killings, assassinations, etc.
Do you mean outside their own ethnic group they'll employ?
Yeah. So yeah. I mean, you know, so a Turkish, like the Eren family, who are basically the Tottenham Turks, and the Armagan family, who are the Hackney Turks. They, a lot of, you know, cases where they've been, you know, in a murder case where they're killing a rival, but the actual gunmen are, you know, black British gunmen. So, you know, cases where, you know, a Turkish guy is shot down and you think, and then there's the suspect running away, it's a black guy. So you think, how can that be Turkish? But obviously they're doing it on the orders of their Turkish paymasters.
And does it cause, like, an issue with policing? I'm sure, like, they will use, in order to disrupt any surveillance activities on them, I'm sure they will use their own languages and at times their own dialects. Does that make it more, you know, increasingly difficult for police to, you know, to try and break into these gangs and gain intelligence on them? Or has the police force in itself become as multicultural as the gangs?
Well, no, it definitely does make it more difficult. I think they probably struggle to recruit. I mean, traditionally, there has been a lot of resistance among in the sort of black Afro-Caribbean community in London to join the police. You know, it's a bit like in Northern Ireland, where if you're a Catholic, you don't tend to join the police, or don't, you know, it's kind of seen as not the done thing. And that they're not trusted. And so there have been that difficulties. Also difficulties getting enough Turkish officers, Albanian officers, you know, who can speak the language and you know, fit in and blend in as undercover officers or whatever. So yeah, that is definitely a difficulty. I mean, in an unrelated case recently, where there's a police officer who's clearly, you know, English, and he was sort of overhearing a conversation between the guy he was following and another guy, and they were talking in Jamaican patois, and he obviously couldn't really follow what they were talking about. So it's obviously difficult.
So it helps the criminals, like, they'll use everything. I wanted to ask you that the last couple of stories we've spoken about that have come from the Old Bailey, that these significant, I suppose, underworld murders that are happening, they're all happening, you know, in broad daylight on streets in London. Is there outrage still, or is the, like ourselves, are you getting more and more used to these things happening and it's harder and harder to outrage the public, really?
Yeah, I think it's the latter. It's a quite a sad sort of blasé attitude by a lot of people. You know, unless you can get, you know, somebody, if the victim were to be 9 years old or a, you know, 75-year-old woman or in a pensioner or something, it's probably not even going to make a headline. It's not going to, certainly not make a front page story.
Or Chris, a white woman. I mean, let's say it straight. I mean, you know, a lot of these ethnic cases, people aren't interested in them because they don't feel that they're important enough. But, you know, you have if you had, you know, a white guy dead on the street from a middle class community, there might be more to be said about it. It might even make it to the Houses of Commons.
Yeah, well, it's a controversial point, but I think it's surprising how few MPs in London, for example, who will say anything about, you know, the amount of young people, you know, young black guys in particular, who are being killed every day, every week. They're you know, frequently criticizing the police for a stop and search and this and that, but not, you know, no, you don't very rarely hear an MP step up and say, these gangs are an outrage. You know, what people need to go to the police and, you know, tell them whatever you want, or, you know, this is a tragedy that this is happening to our young people. It's a very controversial political subject, so I better not say any more. But it's
was there anybody there for the victim in this case? I mean, he's 23. He's a drug dealer. You know, he's somebody who is living by the sword. Was there anybody in court for him? Was there anybody there speaking out for him? Yeah.
I mean, he was like, obviously, you know, you read about it and it sounds like just a two-dimensional bad guy drug dealer. But he obviously meant a lot to people. His girlfriend was in court. Simone and his, I think they might have had a child together, I think. And his mother was absolutely distraught. You know, every time I saw her in court, she looked you know, like she was struggling to hold it together. Only last week they put off the sentencing, and she just ran out of the court sobbing. You know, she just, obviously she wanted some closure. She wanted the people who killed her son to, or the person who killed her son, to get a substantial sentence. And it was put off for, you know, reasons of convenience to the defendants, which must have really, you know, hurt.
And was there any reaction from her, for example, to the other mother in this case, Sophia Kokinos, who's the matriarch of the family and who has been convicted and is now, for perverting the course of justice, is now facing a sentence, albeit it won't be very lengthy, I imagine, but she will be facing prison. But was there any reaction between the two mothers or any interaction between them?
No, but not yet, but I wouldn't be surprised, you know, when she's eventually sentenced that it breaks out. I mean, it was, I think the police had been, or the court clerks, it's the ushers, had been doing a job keeping them apart, because Sophia Kokinos was on bail. I saw her outside the court during the trial and after, on that day of the supposed sentencing. And Jean-Luc Guay's mother, you know, was mingling in the same corridor. So they could easily have sort of bumped into each other. Yes, that could have. So I imagine they were being kept apart, you know, different parts of the building.
Well, it just shows it's a little bit of an eye opener into that world and how little life is worth. And but at the same time, I think, and you see it all the time in your work, how many people are left behind to grieve. And, you know, each life does mean something to families. So, Chris Summers, thank you very much.
No worries. Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com. Produced by Ian Mullaney and edited by me, Nicola Tallant. If you like the podcast and love true crime, why not download the SundayWorld.com app for lots more stories from Ireland and across the globe.